The book title is direct, Asylum, A Memoir and Manifesto. Both parts are compelling. The dangerous and soul-crushing journey through homophobic circles in Nigeria, as well as the clear-eyed but ultimately hope-filled appreciation for America and its continued promise that the author, Adafe Oporo, brings to his story. Ordained in Africa, Adafe Oporo brings a rare personal familiarity with the ways religion is being misused to advance Western interests there while marginalizing LGBT persons and their very lives. Adafe, congratulations on this powerful book, and thank you for making time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm excited to be here. I look forward to this conversation.
Let me start with the impossible question, because you wrote a whole book, briefly, and that's what makes it impossible. Could you say where you started and where you've ended up as described in the memoir part of this new book?
Yeah, I grew up in Warri, Nigeria, which is the south of Nigeria. I grew up in the Delta by the Atlantic Ocean. I was the last in a family of four. I was the first in my family to have a college education. While I was in college, I used to be a pastor of a church. I left the church because of homophobia, and I became an activist, providing access to treatment for LGBTQ identified people in Nigeria, which put my life in danger, and I had to flee. I came to the U.S. seeking asylum at JFK, and I was incarcerated as an asylum seeker. I stayed in a detention center for 6 months. I was granted asylum, and I was allowed to stay in America as a refugee. And now I work with refugees across the country, providing access to technology that will help them rebuild their lives in a new country. As a brief short stop.
That's pretty brief, but that's sort of like saying the story of America is we fought a war and now we have a country. So let's fill in one spot in the middle. Would you talk about the life-changing night when you were 26? I think it's impossible for most of us to imagine what happened, yet it wasn't even unusual in that time and place.
Yeah, so in Nigeria, there are seven states that practice Sharia law. And in Sharia law, you could be stoned to death for being a gay-identified person. In my community where I live in Abuja, I was working with gay men who were HIV positive and were not having access to quote-unquote treatment, so which was increasing the death mortality rates of gay-identified men. And while I was doing this work, I won an award for my work as a public health activist. The night of my birthday, I was woken up with banging on my door. People were screaming that he's gay. We have found out and we're going to kill him. You know, I ran to the back of my apartment, which is like a one bedroom. I wanted to jump out from the window. The other side, there were a lot of people there too. And they broke my door. I was just having my pants on. They dragged me onto the streets. And they were like beating me up with sticks and woods. And children were singing behind me, he's gay. I found out and we're going to kill him. It was just like celebrating my 26th birthday, the night before, and waking up in the morning to this mob attack. And I blacked out during that attack. And when I woke up, I found myself in a clinic and I had to flee. This is like a brief explanation because if I go deep in, it kind of affects me later on. So I try to like make it as brief as possible.
Sure. Wow, that's quite a story. Adafe, you were ordained in Africa and were able to see up close some of the connections between religion and there in particular homophobic religion and foreign interests. What do we need to know about these connections between domestic religious practice in Nigeria and the influence of foreign groups that have come into the country?
So just to set the situation, I joined the church when I was younger because my grandmother, she attended Pentecostal church, and she used to say all the time that she would tell her friends that Adafe is going to become a pastor. I wanted to become a pastor because I felt like it's the most noble thing to do in my community. But when I was a teenager, I started having feelings for other men, and it was difficult for me to be openly gay and be a pastor. And I decided to join the church then with the intention of like hiding my sexual orientation. Because if I was a pastor, people wouldn't ask me, where's your girlfriend? When are you getting married? Or such kind of questions. But while I was a pastor, I met another person that was a priest of a Catholic church, and he was hiding his sexuality. He was a little bit older than me. Then I saw what my future would be if I continue hiding my sexual orientation. So that was why I came out as gay. But after coming out, I was excommunicated from the church because the church in Nigeria do not want anything to do with gay identified persons. And these have a deep root to Nigerians trying to distinct themselves from the West, because Western evangelicals who come to Africa kind of teach a message that the West have already lost the battle with like the sanctity of humanity, and Africans, especially West Africans, have to protect themselves from such kind of demonic polarization, which is like homosexuality being accepted in the West. When I grew up Anglican, when the church in UK wedded the first two gay couple, the church, the Anglican Church of Nigeria, broke out from the Anglican Church in UK because they want to distinct themselves from that identity. In 2012, when Obama came to Africa, they didn't allow him to come to Nigeria because they felt like he was propagating this Western philosophy of like homosexuality on the continent of Africa. That led to the first bill in Uganda that was called the Kill the Gay Bills. And the Kill the Gay Bills was funded by Western evangelicals who wanted Ugandans to show that they are strong in their faith. And from that legislation led to the Nigerian government passing the Same-Sex Marriage Prohibition Act, which criminalizes same-sex relation by 14 years imprisonment. So Africans are trying to distinct themselves from the West because Western evangelicals spend a lot of money, they call it dark money, trying to promote an ideal African continent that's clean from this Western homosexuality propaganda.
There are lots of evangelical churches in the United States and lots of associations of evangelical churches. Are there specific groups that have a focus on Nigeria?
In the book, I made mention of some of the specific groups that focus in Nigeria. But, you know, as after writing the book, I've been thinking about it. You know, it's like categorizing the entire religion based on one or two evangelical groups that broke out into the continent of Africa. And most people in the U.S. do not know that the money they are giving to church are foiling such kind of stuff. So I don't want people to lose their faith in God because somebody in their religion did something that was repelling. But most evangelical churches from the South of the United States for these homosexuality acts and the anti-homosexuality bills in the continent of Africa. If you just type on Google religious dark money, spoiling homophobia, you're going to see articles about it. They have even done, they have done peer-reviewed research recently on some of these evangelical churches. Because me, I'm still a person of faith, right? And I don't want to be the person that pushes people from their relationship with their religious organization, because faith really plays a role in who I am as a person.
I'm always in favor of giving our curious listeners a little homework to do to fill out the interview. So that was a great answer. Tell me, Adafi, what harm was and is being done to the LGBTQI+ community in the name of religion in Nigeria? And how much of it is fed by economic and political agendas?
So I think 90% of it is economic, political agenda, because, you know, if you are living in a country whereby there's corruption and there's poverty, and an evangelical organization from the West is bringing in millions of dollars, it kind of changes your perception of like what you do as a person. Number one, there's what is called conversion therapy that most evangelical churches do. It's like exorcism, whereby they bring the child into the church, they pray for them to pray the day away. And this is torture, quote unquote, because the kids are asked to fast. Sometimes they are tied with rope and flogged to like whip out the demonic spirit from them. And when laws are passed, like the anti-homosexuality bill that was passed in Nigeria, this gave rise to non-state actors, that's people that do not have the power to exercise the laws, to take laws into their hands. For example, when I was beaten up by a mob, I couldn't go to the government to report. Because the mob were saying that if I report, they will take me to the government and that will lead to 14 years imprisonment. So this kind of anti-homophobia law give rise to hate and stigma to LGBTQ people, leading a lot of people to flee away from their countries to find a place where they could be themselves. There was a study that was done by the Human Rights Watch that found out that 97% of Nigerians say that homosexuality is the cause of the country wars. And if you go online on social media, most people, when they argue against homosexuality, the argument is like Old Testament, and Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed because of the act of homosexuality. And I think that as a gay person who has gone through persecution, that the idea of gay people being persecuted is not just only wrong, it's even against the Bible, because the Bible said that we should leave it for our God to judge the people that do things wrong. And I think that I don't believe that homosexuality is wrong because I'm a gay person. But I still believe that there should be freedom of religion, but religious organization should not use religion to harm other people, because that's what Christ's teaching was all about. It's like, do not harm your neighbors, do not cause any harm to any other person. It should be left between the individual and their God to decide, because this is pushing a lot of people away from having a relationship with God. You know that 90% of gay people run away from the church, not because they don't want to practice religion or the Islamic religion or major Abrahamic faith religion. They run away because they feel like they wouldn't be accepted for who they are. So I think that growing up in a country whereby religion was like the bread and butter of our lives, I wake up, I go to church on Sunday, I do Bible study on Wednesday, prayer meeting on Friday, all my friends were in the church. So being prevented from having communication with those people lead to isolation. And some people end up taking up their life because they feel like they're not worthy to be alive. So I think that sometimes some of the complications that result from anti-homophobic religious views are not documented because the people are not even able to speak up about the inhumane experiences they have had. Losing ties with their family, close friends, and connection is isolating.
I'll talk more with Adafe Oporo in just a minute. And later, Ross Keyes of Interfaith Alliance of North Dakota. If you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows, all at stateofbelief.com. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. there were challenges for you going through the asylum system in America as well. What effect would those challenges have on survivors of violence and danger who enter the system trying to escape persecution in their homeland?
First of all, detention centers are all across the United States. And detention is a form of torture. So like, I was fleeing from my country because I don't want to go to jail and came to America and I was placed on handcuffs and taken to jail. You know, that kind of further complicates the mental health of individuals who come here to seek protection. I think that it's difficult for you to rebuild your life if you feel like you don't have what as a human being and you're like an alien in this new country. First of all, when a new refugee, like a displaced person, goes to a new country, UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, says it takes averagely 17 years to resettle in a new country. So sometimes you have to learn a new language, you might have to go back to school, social cues are different. So when you stay in a jail for some time and you now come into the society because of that low self-esteem and maltreatment you have faced, you become difficult for you to be like, feel any sense of worth as a human being. Asylum is an opportunity for people to rebuild their lives. I think many people feel like detention should be there because it's a way of like documenting people before they come into the country. But most Western countries do not use detention as a system of like welcoming new immigrants. And if we go back historically, use of detention was to deter Black and brown migrants from coming into America. So I feel like our treatment of immigrants in America is mostly geared towards Black and brown people coming from Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, or Asia. Most people who come from Europe do not face such kind of sentimental backlash because it's like signaling. If you come to the airport, you're Black, you like that. That's how they signal you to be, go to the side. You get to face more rigorous kind of like documentation. In America, when we talk about immigration, we always think about people coming here. And we never think about why would somebody leave their home to come here to seek protection? And if someone flee their home to come to America, why would we have them to go through a system that makes them feel less of a human being? And that is something I think is surprising for me, because when I was coming to America, I had a different perception of what America is. I think that America is like, it's like the land of the free, the home of the brave. That was my idea of America. But going through the asylum system made me have a different idea of what America is.
So let's talk about the other part of your book, building on what we've heard you say already, the manifesto section. What are you calling for, and from whom should it come?
I think systemic change in America is very difficult because we have a 50-50 split Senate. The last time they had a comprehensive immigration reform was in 1980. The U.S. Congress passed the Refugee Act of 1980. That was what gave rise to the opportunity for people to seek asylum. But now I'm calling for the humane treatment of immigrants. Like the idea that guided the book was that home is not just where you feel safe and welcome only, but how you make it feel safe and welcome for others. I'm not saying that we should open the doors for everybody to come to America. But when someone is fleeing persecution and gets to the door of America, it should be left to the judicial system to decide if the person is worthy to stay in America. So why are we citizens who do not have a legal understanding of the asylum system saying that people should not come here? If I came here and I wasn't given the opportunity to see an immigration judge, maybe I might have died in my own country for just being who I am as a gay person. Many people come in here, that is their quest, is an opportunity to rebuild their lives in a new country. And I think that's what all America is all about, is that it's the dream that if you come here, you can have an opportunity to have a good education, to be with your wife, and to be able to have a family. And that is what I'm asking for Americans to do, is to look at our lives and think, if our fathers, our great-grandfathers come here and they were given an opportunity to review their life, why are we shutting the door for people who are coming here to seek the same opportunity?
So knowing what you know now about America, where should this change originate? Does it need to come initially from Congress, from activists, from candidates? Tell me.
I think it starts with individuals, because the power of the people is stronger than the power of the government, because the people chooses our government. If more people become aware of these inhumane treatment, like detention, like lack of support of social services, people can start thinking what they can do. I think it's little acts of kindness that really help more than legislation. For example, when I came to the US and I was released from the detention center, I was homeless. Just a group of volunteers from an organization called First Friends of New Jersey and New York that rented a shelter at the YMCA for me to stay in. Like when I was preparing for my first interview, there's an organization called Dress for Success. That's where I got a suit. Volunteers donated MetroCard for me to attend my first interview. And, you know, when they say it takes averagely 17 years to review their life. So if the government passed a legislation that enables people to seek asylum, then it's left up to individuals in America to make it welcoming for those people who get here. So I think it's individual change that will lead to a systemic change in America, because our Congress is dead. I wouldn't shy away from that. Congress has not even talked about immigration for a very long time. In 2015, they tried to pass the Dreamers Act. It didn't go through. So other countries are thinking about, like, labor laws. How can they make it easier for people to come into their countries to seek labor? America is becoming an aging population. Japan, for example, is an aging population. We need younger people to work to be able to pay into Social Security so that older people can have a better retirement. And if more and more we are restricting immigration as a country, we are preventing ourselves from the rich diversity that makes us a melting pot that people talk about. And we're limiting ourselves from opportunity, from innovation and other areas in that will make the country more successful. Immigrants contribute to the economy of America more than what they take from America.
You know, listening to your story, it would be easy for you to become pretty cynical about people and about humanity in general. And yet there is a redemptive vision for humanity that pervades everything you write and everything you say. Can you talk about some of the commonalities you admire among people that you found in Nigeria and in New York and along the way to where you've arrived today?
Yeah. You know, as a gay person, when I came out and left my family, the only family I had were other gay people I met in Abuja, Nigeria, like Bobby, who gave me a place to stay for me to be able to have a job. When I came to America, I wanted to find community in the gay community, but I was a refugee, so they regarded me as a refugee. In the refugee community, I'm Black, I'm African. In the African community, I'm gay. So every community I found myself in, I was like an other. So the only way I could really create a community is to find people who are passionate about making the world a better place. And those people, yeah, like the people that I met at the detention center, who were part of a group visiting people at the detention center. And I would say, I was pretty shocked that there are more kinder people than people who don't want immigrants to succeed in America. That has been my experience, that Americans in general are kind people because, you know, everywhere I go to, I see people who are willing to help and make life better for me. Instead of me to be cynical, I had to embrace that openness that people had, that if people want me to succeed, then why would I not put myself in a position to succeed? That's how I see the world, is that you have to be hopeful rather than cynical. Even the Bible said that even though you have faith as little as mustard seed, you can move mountains. So people had faith in me that were as big as mountains. So I just needed to have a little faith as a mustard seed. And that's what I did. And I met people with good karma.
Well, you are a deeply faithful person as well, and yet you've been injured in lots of ways by the traditions that you've attempted to be a part of. I think that's probably the experience for lots of people in the LGBT community. What would you tell them about maintaining their faith in the face of sometimes antagonistic religious institutions?
I think that our faith has nothing to do with people. It's all about our relationship with a divine being. And if you allow people to shape or refrain you from having that relationship, then those people have won. I think it's not allowing them to win over us, because the reason why we are able to win gay rights is not just because of gay people alone. There were people who were not gays that were allies. There's only 4% of gay people in America. The remaining 96% are non-gay. So if those people are not allies, we wouldn't have gotten anywhere. So I would say, just act like the way Jesus acted. That is to be a peacemaker, a lover of humanity, and just continue to have faith that everything will be okay. Because when I was younger, I never saw people that were gay in the church, in my community. I never saw people. And if I had given up right then, right now, I wouldn't be an example to other younger people who see me and feel like they can have a life too as a gay person. So if you hold on to your faith and you continue to live life joyously and faithfully, one day your life will be an example to other people. And even people that hate you would say, I wish to be like that person, because they're a true example of what it is to be a Christian.
So imagine yourself being one of those young people, you yourself, Adafe. What would you say to the young man you were that would have benefited you in making the progress to the wise and mature man you've become?
I don't want to cry. I would say...
It's always a successful day for me when I can make someone cry. So go ahead.
I would just say, like, keep on having faith. My earphone fell. I'll just say, keep on having faith that everything will be fine. Because I grew up in a family where we lived on less than $1 a day. And now I'm living in New York City. I just graduated from my master's in NYU. I got married 2 weeks ago. And I couldn't have imagined any of this growing up. So I don't know what I would have told him that would have made a difference. Just keep on having faith and looking up to people that inspire you, and have faith that one day it should be okay. Because I don't know what I would have said. I don't know.
Well, you did a great job in answering a difficult question, and and I appreciate everything that you've done for us in this conversation today, Adafe. Adafe Oporo is a successful management consultant in New York City, a global gay rights activist, and founder of Refuge America. He shares his journey from Nigerian refugee to American success story and testifies to the challenges and obstacles within the asylum system in the book Asylum, A Memoir and Manifesto. Adafe, it is a powerful work. Thank you so much for making the time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much.